So, I'm going to be the chairman of the quantum optics session this afternoon. My name is Zsolt Kis. I'm a researcher at the Wigner Research Center for Physics. So, our first speaker will be Professor Hellwig Ott from the Technical University of Kaiserslautern. Let me introduce him briefly. He's a professor of experimental physics at the Technical University of Kaiserslautern. He's also the dean of the physics department. He studied physics at the University of Tübingen, then he did his PhD also there. His supervisor was Professor Klaus Zimmermann. After finishing his PhD, he was a Marie Curie Fellow at Lens, Florence. Later, he led an Emmy Noether Junior Research Group at the University of Mainz. From 2009, he's a full professor for experimental physics at TU Kaiserslautern. His main research interest is experimental cold atom physics, so he's doing fascinating experiments with cold atoms. So please.
Yeah, thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me. It's really a great pleasure and honor to be here. So I want to share with you results on ultra-cold Bose gases in driven dissipative environments. In particular, I will show you how you can use such system to study first-order dissipative phase transitions. And I have to say that the CV that I sent you was in one detail, not topic. And that was that I'm no longer at the TU Kaiserslautern. I come from the youngest university in Kaiserslautern. It exists only since the January of this year, and it's the Rheinland-Pfälzische Technische Universität Kaiserslautern-Landau. So we have been merged with another university. So that's why there is no longer a TU Kaiserslautern, as some of you might remember, but it's the RPTU. So I will guide you through this along some starting with a little introduction on how we describe the systems we are interested in. I will then introduce to you a very important, conceptually very important system that has been studied for quite a long time to understand how this driven dissipation system comes about and how this then leads to a first order dissipative phase transition. In our case, we do this with ultra-cold atoms. We do this with a quantum gas. And at the end, I will also comment on newer results where we particularly looked at the hysteresis of such a system. And I also give you a little bit of insight on how one might theoretically describe the system because it is more complex than what is known from this optical bistability. Now, the motivation for us is to love our environment, to put our quantum gas not in a unitary setting that everything is Hamiltonian and unitary, but we want to couple it explicitly in a controlled way to an environment. And I will tell you how we do that in a moment. But let me just say, if you decide to steer your quantum gas externally, then there is a couple of things that pop up and that you can study. For instance, you can go for periodically driving, and then you are in the realm of Floquet systems. That is still some kind of unitary. But of course, you can maybe add several frequencies, and then you can make a smooth transition from unitary time evolution to a non-unitary time evolution. In such systems, for instance, you get effective Hamiltonians that are very interested and can have properties that you are not able to engineer by just static systems. Especially in the context of open quantum systems, as we are studying it, there are two important concepts. So you can use the openness of your system to prepare certain quantum states. And if you manage to do so, then at the same time, you also get an attractor dynamics towards a steady state that you design. So also from an engineering point of view, this is a powerful concept. And again, if you couple your system to something else, then transport is a natural thing to appear. And we particularly here focus on the phase transitions in open systems, so first order dissipative phase transition. And in a mean field picture, very often, you can use such coupling to environments, to non-Hermitian Hamiltonians. And some of you certainly know that there's a whole field on its own to have Hamiltonians that have an I and minus I. And then there's the whole world of PT symmetric Hamiltonians also involved into that. But for today, this will be the main topic. So let's start a little bit hand wavy by what we are doing in the experiment and also motivating them how this connects to the phase transition. So we work with atoms in an optical lattice, bosonic atoms in an optical lattice sketched here. But what is special about our experiment is that we are able to introduce losses at certain lattice sites. So this is the kind of the environment we are coupling the system to. So it's leaky, but in a controlled way. We are just not only losing atoms everywhere, but only at particular sites. And then there is the immediate question, how would you describe this theoretically? And in the second quantization, you would write down such a Lindblad master equation here, where you have your Hamiltonian time evolution, which is kind of everything you know from your Bose-Hubbard model that describes the system. But then on top of that, you have jump operators acting at your systems. These jump operators here in this formalism are the concrete representation is just annihilation and creation operators of atoms at each lattice site. And this gamma that appears here is just the rate at which this occurs. So if you think of this equation, it all tells you the change in your density matrix comes from the Hamiltonian dynamics plus quantum jumps that occur with the rate gamma. And a quantum jump means you apply A at your system, so you have one atom less in this lattice site. That has been pushed forward here in these three publications, especially in the context for ultra-cold atoms. Now, this is a quantum description. One could immediately ask, if you have many atoms, maybe is it really necessary to go to the quantum description? So what are appropriate mean field descriptions of such a system? And if you work at a zero temperature, then for the lattice system that I show you here, all this boils down to this famous model here. You now have only wave functions in your lattice sites. These wave functions are well-defined C numbers. They can tunnel from one side to the other here, and you have a nonlinearity. So you have an interaction, a term which comes from the S-wave scattering between the atoms. And now the losses that you had, that was previously this jump operator, now in a mean field picture boils down to having an imaginary potential. And that only acts at a certain site, and only at the sites where you have your losses acting. And if you put a look at this, how this looks like, then this is simply a Josephson, a 1D chain of Josephson junctions coupled to each other. Another useful thing is what we also did, I will not talk about, we looked at losses of atoms where we had no lattice at all. So we also might wonder what is a mean field description if you do not have a lattice, but if you just have a bulk system, and then you can show that you end up with this dynamical equation here, which the first part here is nothing else than the Cross-Pitayevsky equation, kinetic energy, potential energy, and interaction energy. But what is now on top of it, if you have local losses, is that again, you get an imaginary potential here with a minus sign. This describes your losses. And this is your kind of spatial profile of your loss rate. And for instance, we have shown in one of our very early publications that such an imaginary potential can be used to reflect atoms. And this is also what you can easily calculate in quantum mechanics if you plug in an imaginary potential in your one-dimensional Schrödinger equation. So I want to speak about first order dissipative phase transition. Let's recap what phase transitions are. The classical ones, first and second order, you have an order parameter here that at a critical point makes a jump for a first order phase transition. This is associated with a free energy that goes from above the critical point from this minimum for zero order parameter to a finite value of U. And at the critical point, you have these two minima coexisting. And in a second order phase transition, the order parameter here goes continuously from zero to a finite value, and your free energy goes from one minimum here continuously to another minimum at a finite value of your order parameter. For instance, the BEC phase transition is an example for that one. Now, we want to deal with dissipative systems. So there is gain, there is loss. This is a different language. We have a Lindblad operator. So the question is, what is the appropriate classification of what a phase transition is? And in this respect, it is instructive if we look first again at this equation here, the dynamical equation that governs such systems, so this master equation here with this operator, and we just do a spectral analysis of this master equation, but by looking at this eigenvalue equation here for this density matrices rho I that are stationary and have this lambda I in front of it as the eigenvalue. Then one can show, and when I say one can show, I mainly refer to this paper here by Cristiano Ciuti, where this is all sorted out quite nicely. that there has to be one solution of this equation here where the eigenvalue lambda is zero. And along with this eigenvalue lambda equals zero, there is a density matrix, rho zero, where the trace is one. So you all know this, that's just describing a proper physical system, so it's trace preserving here. The important point is that this state then, when the eigenvalue lambda here is zero, this means that the time over evolution of this rho I is zero. In other words, this rho zero is a steady state. It does not change in time. It stays there. And that is the first important message. Every system like that has at least one steady state that does not change in time, that has eigenvalue lambda equals zero. But of course, there are many more solutions to this equation than just this one with eigenvalue zero. But all of that then have something in common. And this is that the negative real part of lambda is bigger than one. And if you think of this quantity having a negative real part that is bigger than one, and you look at the time evolution for the corresponding solution rho I, then you realize that this decays exponentially in time. And what you also find is that these type of solutions, which don't have lambda gleich null, lambda equals zero, they have a vanishing trace. So that tells you that any proper density operator that you want to write down and that describes your system has to have a contribution from rho zero, from the steady state that is really long time stable. And then of course you can admix many, many other excited state, and this is then a general description of your state. The important part is now, if you look at the time evolution of your system, you start with a superposition of many, many density matrices, then the only one that survives is rho zero, because that has eigenvalue lambda zero. All others have a finite lambda, they have a finite decay rate. So after a certain time, all these contributions disappear. And that tells you that wherever you start from, you end up in a well-defined steady state. And this is why I was referring to at the beginning, that in such driven dissipative systems, you can easily get an attractor dynamics. And if you manage to design your steady state in a very interesting way, then you will really get this steady state of interest. Now, if you look at all these different eigenvalues lambda, then there is one that has the smallest negative real part of it. And this is then called the Liouvillian gap, because this is the last rho I that decays in time before you have reached the steady state at the end. And this is then kind of the slowest relaxation rate in your system, and it gives you an idea of how long you have to time propagate until you reach that steady state. Now, the first order dissipative phase transition now comes all about. If you consider now a parameter theta on which your system depends on, and there is now a critical value, rho theta. And left of this rho theta, you get a certain steady state, let's call this rho one, that has certain properties. And above this value, you have another steady state, rho plus, which describes a different steady state. And at the phase transition, at this critical point, the system transits from one type of steady state to another type of steady state. And this is exactly what the phase transition means. In order to make this happen, what has to happen theoretically is that this Liouvillian gap exactly becomes zero at the position of the phase transition, so that you have two solutions that have eigenvalue lambda equals to zero. They are here indicated here and here, and left and right, you have either one or the other. And the order parameter that describes your steady state, this is now in the thermodynamic limit allowed to change discontinuously from one state to another state. And this is where the notion first order dissipative phase transition comes from, if this is a discontinual change of your order parameter at that point. So at this point, there is a bistability, because here you have two states, the steady state that always exists, but another one, the red one here, which also has lambda value lambda equals zero. And as in any first order phase transition point, if you go across the phase transition, you expect to observe hysteresis, because your system needs a certain time to adapt. And if you go too fast across the phase transition, you remain still for a while in the steady state that you come from before you relax to the new one. Now, we are not working in the thermodynamic limit. We are working with finite size systems. What does this mean? This means first that in our situation, we don't expect this Liouvillean gap to become zero, so that we have really two long-term stable steady state, but we have still relaxation even at a critical point, and we have rather than bistability, we expect something more like metastability. And also in the thermodynamic limit here, left and right, you have two distinct steady states, and in a finite system, the steady state here and here are kind of mixed and see already contributions from the other steady state. Okay, this was now a long introduction. Let's apply it now to one of the most fundamental problems that has been studied already since many, many years, and this is optical bistability. What does it do? It considers a single mode Hamiltonian here, which has a single mode which has an interaction energy, it has a detuning, and it has an external coherent drive. And in addition to this Hamiltonian dynamics, it has losses. Now, if this is a little bit too abstract, here is the concrete realization, how you can realize such a system. You take a resonator, it can be an optical resonator, you put a nonlinear medium inside a, sorry, you put a nonlinear medium inside a resonator, and then you have a pump laser that has a certain detuning to your cavity mode, and you have a decay rate of your cavity. So these are the ingredients that are exactly providing you this coupled set of equations. And let's first have a look at the mean field equation of that. So what do you expect? The interesting part of this system is that because of this nonlinearity in the medium, you have a cubic equation for the steady state. So the question is, how many photons do you have in the cavity fulfilling these equations here? And in the mean field solution, let's have a look here at this plot graph B here. So what is plotted here on the x-axis is kind of the pump power, so the F, how strong your laser is that goes into the cavity. And here is the number of photons in the cavity for a given parameters. And the number of photons in the cavity that now plays the role of the order parameter that tells you in which steady state you are. And you see there, for low pumping, there is low photon number, there is high photon number. But the mean field solution now tells you, because it's a cubic equation, that you have three solutions for the photon number inside the cavity. And this is represented by the dashed line here. And you see there is a certain area in which three solutions coexist. The middle one is not so interesting because this is unstable in any case, but there is a solution up here and down here that in the mean field description are stable. So you would say this cavity, if I pump it, it can either have low atom, a low photon number, or high photon number. And why are the two solutions allowed? You can imagine that this comes directly from the nonlinearity, because if you have enough photons in the cavity, then the nonlinearity can bring your cavity into resonance with the incoming laser beam. And then it stabilizes itself at a high photon number. Or at the same time, if you don't have enough photons there, you are stable at a low photon number. And that is the reason for these two stable steady states. Now, the big contribution of these two famous quantum optic guys was that this is not the end of the story, because there can be quantum tunneling. So photons can tunnel out of the cavity, there are quantum fluctuations. And in this picture, this means that the system can tunnel from one branch to the other. So it can tunnel from high photon number to low photon number and back. And if you just now ask the question, what is the steady state? Then the quantum solution tells you, the quantum treatment tells you, there is only one unique steady state at every time. And this is the orange line here. And if you look at this solution and, for instance, at the statistics of photon number, you see a bimodal distribution. This is the remainder of this bistability. But especially if you look at the time evolution of your system, if you sit your system on such a parameter, then this time evolution jumps between the two solutions, between low photon number and high photon number, and you get a telegraph signal. And that is then kind of the signature of quantum fluctuations at such a dissipative phase transition. Okay, now we are interested in that because, let me first summarize, give you just two more examples here. That was just theory, what I told you. Here is an experiment from exciton polariton condensates. They have the semiconductor structures in a cavity, but most importantly, what you see here on the right side, these are time traces on the photons that go through the system, and you see that they exactly show this type of switching behavior between high occupation number and low occupation number, depending on system parameters. And similar experiments have also done, for instance, here in circuit Q. Okay, this is with photons, this is with a single mode. So what can we add now in our system? This is how it looks like. We use an array of Bose-Einstein condensates in a one-dimensional optical lattice, and we apply dissipation to one of the lattice sites. So we remove atoms from one site, and neighboring sites are coherently coupled to the lossy site via quantum mechanical tunneling in this optical lattice. Now, what is particular about our experiment, and this is maybe a worldwide unique feature, is that we have an ultra-cold quantum gas in a vacuum chamber, but at the same time, we have an installed scanning electron microscope with which we look at the atoms. And this microscope can do various things. In particular, it can remove atoms because it's a high-energy electron beam, and if this hits an ultra-cold atom, it just kicks the atom away. So it's a direct way of implement losses dissipation in your system. We can go for very high spatial resolution here, 100 nanometer. We can use this to detect single atoms because we have an ion detector that is also detecting what we remove, and the fraction of what we remove is ionized. We can do this for imaging. You will see a couple of pictures in a minute. The nice thing is it's a really an in situ measure. And most importantly for this talk, it's an in vivo measurement. So we can really make continuous measurements at a certain position in the cloud while the whole unitary quantum dynamics goes on. So we can kind of implement this Lindblad master equation type of physics here. Now here is how what we concentrated at the beginning, just to play around here. You see all of this are atomic clouds, density distribution in optical lattices. This is the 1D optical lattice, the 2D optical lattice, having single defects, emptying some sites. All this you can do by playing with freezing out the motion in your system, removing atoms. And this allows you, for instance, to create certain interesting starting conditions. Now, the system we have studied for this particular project was an elongated Bose-Einstein condensate here, subject to a one-dimensional optical lattice. And as you can see in this electron microscope picture, this is cut into slices. Yeah? And each slice contains about a few hundred atoms. And this is a small condensate. So we have pancake-shaped condensates, one after the other. And now what we do for the experiment, we choose one of those sites to remove atoms from that particular site. And we consider the left and the right part of our cloud as the reservoirs. So there are condensates there. So there are many atoms, and they can tunnel into that site. And this is now our drive and dissipation in the same sense as in the optical bistability experiment here. There is one resonator, which is one lattice site. There are losses. There's nonlinearity because atoms, they always interact, these ultra-cold atoms, and there is coherent drive from the site. Now in the experiment, how we do this, we start with this BC in the 1D lattice that you've seen. We freeze out tunneling, so atoms are not allowed to move anymore. Every condensate is independent, and then we either remove the atoms from one side or we don't remove the atoms from one side. In other words, we have either an empty lattice site at the beginning of the experiment or one that has the same filling as the neighboring ones. Then we reduce the lattice, we switch on the dissipation, so we switch on the electron beam. This is now constantly testing the cloud, and then we look at the time evolution of the system. And here I show you exemplary trajectories, so single trajectories of your system where here we start from an initially empty site, so low occupation number, and it stays there for quite a while, hundreds of more than 100 milliseconds, and then it all of a sudden jumps to a filling that is similar to the neighboring sites. And also if we start from a full site, so full means as many atoms as in the neighboring sites, then we see this drop down to a low filling occurring at random times. So first, I would like to point out that this is really a drastic type of jump, because in a very short moment of time here, a few milliseconds here, hundreds of atoms jump from these reservoir sites into the lossy site. or they disappear there from the dissipation. So these are really violent jumps, if you like. And from the probability, how long in average it takes to make the jump upwards and how long in average takes to get the jump downwards, we measure the jump rates in one direction and in the other direction. And this is important because if you know the two jump rates and you add them up, then you have a measure of the Liouvillian gap. So how fast your system relaxes. And this is what we did here. So we changed the parameters. We set a certain dissipation rate. Here, this is gamma equals to 250 hertz. So in kind of like 4 milliseconds, we empty one side. And here we vary the tunnel coupling J between the sides, between these values here. And you see that, and what is plotted here on this side is the effective Liouvillian gap, which means this is the sum of the two jump rates that we measure in the two directions. And you see this rate has a minimum here around here, which is roughly but not equal where J equals gamma, so where you have the competition between how coherently you fill atoms in that side and how you remove them. But clearly, there is a minimum of this effective Liouvillian gap, and this is why we say that this is the indication now in a finite size system of the presence of a first-order dissipative phase transition. So it has the two ingredients: the effective Liouvillian gap. It does not vanish, but it comes very small. The value here is actually only 3 hertz. This is much, much smaller than the individual rates. So we just to tell you again, we have 250 hertz loss rate. We have about 300 something rate tunneling rate, but the relaxation rate is only 3 hertz. So this is also what is often referred to as a critical slowing down of your system dynamics in the vicinity of a phase transition. So you can look up here in this paper to learn more about this. But that's not all we can look at. We can also have take advantage of our capabilities of changing parameters in time. And by this, we can, for instance, as it was done here, we can change the tunneling coupling in the experiment. So this is indicated by this black arrow here. So here we increase the tunneling coupling, and then we go back to the same value here. And what you see here is then the average filling of your side. And if you increase the tunneling coupling, you cross the phase transition. So you go from low occupation number to this high occupation number, and you go back. But the important point is that here there is a finite hysteresis area. And this is just because we do not scan infinitely slow over the phase transition, but we make this in a rush here and here. What is now important, this is the hysteresis area. And what is now important is, of course, the scaling of the hysteresis area. This is something that tells you something about the nature of the phase transition. So let's have again here from theory some results, again on the optical bistability, so not on our system, but on the single mode system here, where for different driving F, that's the coherent coupling here, what was J in our case here, you see again this S-shaped mean field solution. And the two, this is the quantum solution. And what is shown here in blue and in red are kind of the jumps at the edges where the system closes its hysteresis area if you do this dynamically. And there are two predictions. So the first one is that if you do this dynamical hysteresis scaling, you see at two different parameters, you see an occurrence of fluctuations is because you have a preferred value at which your system jumps to the other state. And they have also analyzed how the scaling of the hysteresis area change with a sweep time t. And the mean field prediction is t to the power of minus 2/3 as the scaling, and the exact quantum result is t to the power of minus 1. So how your hysteresis area becomes smaller if you make the scan slower and slower. Now, what do we see in the experiment? These are preliminary results here. First of all, we see that for different sweep times, this is 250 milliseconds for the whole sequence. This is 500 milliseconds for the whole sequence. You first see that the hysteresis area becomes smaller. This is obvious because the smaller you cross the phase transition, the better the system can adapt to the actual steady state. And if you would go, of course, infinitely slow, you would follow this one trajectory in you. And then, of course, what we did, we do this experiment many, many times. And then we make statistics for every point here over time. And we look at the fluctuations. And we see indeed that we see two pronounced peaks of where the G2 of zero, so the atom fluctuations peak. And this does exactly the same as the hysteresis area. These peaks become smaller if you increase the time that you use to jump over that phase transition here. And if you now look at least with a little data range we can capture at the scaling, then we find an exponent of -1 here indicated by this curve here that suggests that indeed we see the same scaling of the hysteresis area as it is expected in optical bistability. Now, we also did something that is peculiar in our system because we have a many-body system and we also have many modes involved. We can look at finite temperature effects. That is not a reasonable notion in this optical bistability. And we see that for increasing temperature, the hysteresis area decreases in time or decreases. And this also tells you that thermal excitation destroy your hysteresis and also tells you that the driving force for this fluctuations are really quantum fluctuations in this. Now, I finally want to discuss the microscopic system dynamics because this is also very peculiar, especially for some of you that are maybe working in the field of ultra-cold quantum gases. I've shown you that in this lattice site, we have filling, no filling, and high filling. And I told you that all the other neighboring lattice sites, they host a condensate. But now if you look at just at this one lattice site here, if you have low filling, there are only 10 atoms, 50 atoms there, then you do not have enough atoms to form a Bose-Einstein condensate. You can just calculate the density and the temperature and you realize there is no condensate possible. So this kind of low filling state is associated with having no Bose-Einstein condensate, whereas the high filling state, it has the same filling as neighboring sites should be a Bose-Einstein condensate. And we have done experiments that clearly prove that, that it is totally phase coherent. So when the system jumps from low filling to high filling, it has to make at the same time a phase transition in a thermodynamic sense from a normal gas to a Bose-Einstein condensate because you rapidly increase the atom number there. And this is something I want to demonstrate you here that this is indeed the case. So what you see here in yellow is the average jump. So we have measured many of those jumps that I've shown you before and we overlay all of them. And then we get the average evolution of the atom number in that side. And here you see that goes from around 200 to 800. And you see that if you just follow this line here, there's actually an exponential growth, but then there's a certain point where this really grows even faster than exponential. So it seems like there is really a threshold that is this dashed line here, where from here the dynamics is ultra fast and ultra efficient in terms of bringing atom from the full side into that leaky side. And we associate this with a Josephson dynamics, so that in that phase, that there is a certain critical atom number at which phase fluctuations can, for a short time, establish phase coherence in that site. And as soon as they have macroscopic phase coherence, you are allowed to think about a Josephson effect between the two sites. And this macroscopic phase coherence, I think, is needed. And it happens while the atoms are accumulating in that site. So this is kind of the way I think about this quantum fluctuation that triggers this jump from low filling to high filling. There is another piece of evidence, and this is here, the blue curve here. This is that at the same time when the atom number runs up, the transverse extent of that site becomes smaller. So even though you have more atoms in your site, the transverse extent becomes smaller. And this is because in a condensate, you can accommodate the atoms at the same average energy in a smaller volume because your short range correlation, the G2 function is only one, and in a normal component, it is two. And that's why a condensate can be smaller at the same average energy per particle. And finally, a last piece of evidence comes from the statistics over how fast is a jump from the low filling to the high filling state. Here is the average result. The average jump is around five tunneling times, this is fast, but maybe not super fast, but we can also show what is the fastest jump that we observe in a single trajectory. And the fastest jumps we observe is always in the order of one tunneling time. So it's really very efficient. And to explain such a strong tunneling, the only possible explanation is that it's really a Josephson dynamics in your systems. Okay, so this is kind of a microscopic picture that we have of this. Now, one slide about the possible theoretical treatment, because as I said, we are not doing exactly this optical bistability that can be treated numerically easily, because it's a one-mode system, but we have many modes, many atoms, that makes it difficult. And here is one example of Matt Davies' group from Australia, who invested quite a lot of time in describing our system. And what they do is a stochastic projected Kras-Podiebski equation here. So they have losses, they have coherent drive, they have this here this Kras-Podiebski type of physics here, over always kind of after every step projecting back to that, but I think it's more like a technical detail. So they have all the ingredients, but what is important is they have noise on it. That's why it's called stochastic. So they have a wave function, and that wave function has noise. And when they use this to describe our system with real data, they see, for instance, here for certain parameter switching behavior as we do it. And they also can see that in a superfluid here, where the phase fluctuations are much smaller, the size of the transverse cloud is smaller. And for a normal component, it is larger. So it captures a lot of what we do. Okay, that brings me now to the end of the talk. So what have we done? What have we achieved? Well, we have studied a dissipated first order dissipated phase transition in a larger called quantum gas. So what is new, you have to keep in mind is that this is an extension of what has been done previously with a single mode system in optics. This is now many transverse modes and many particles. And by the way, also much stronger interactions because there are atoms involved here. And because we are now in this regime, we see qualitatively, of course, a similar behavior because it is a first order dissipative phase transition and things are similar at a phase transition. We even see the same exponent in one experiment. But of course, for the details, you need much more advanced theory to explain it. We have characterized the closing of the Wilhelm gap, have studied hysteresis and microstability, and also see that we have quantum fluctuations that determine the dynamics in the system. And I found this surprising because normally when you think about cold atom experiments and quantum fluctuations, then it's more like one, two atoms fluctuating around. If you think, for instance, what is insulator physics? And here it's such a huge number of atoms that change side. And the microscopic dynamic is very rich if you look at this non-equilibrium condensation process. Now, what remains to do? Of course, we would like to see a little bit more the scaling laws, especially for different temperatures, because, well, there is the dissipated phase transition, but we also have the thermal phase transition from a normal gas to a BEC. And I somehow think they have to kind of be, one should be able to draw them in the same type of graph, maybe in a three-dimensional plot, but I'm not yet sure how to do this properly. And there's also the quest about second-order phase transitions. There is a definition of that, but as far as I know, no one has seen that so far in the experiment, but maybe some of you know that. This is the team. Let me highlight mainly Marvin and Eric, who are running the experiment right now, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you for the nice talk. Are there any questions?
Thank you. When you consider noise in the Schrödinger equation, is that noise real, complex, Gaussian, weak noise?
Let me check. So you're referring, I guess, to this noise here. I think it's delta correlated Gaussian noise.
It's a standard Wiener noise.
Yes, yes, yes. Standard, okay. Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
So if I understood well, you have a continuous measurement on the atom number in the depleted trap site. Is this right? And how do you measure it?
So it's a continuous measurement. Yes, I agree, of the atom number. No, so what we measure physically are the atoms that are removed. So suppose you have a sample of 100 atoms and there is this electron beam, then it removes a certain fraction of atoms in a time. These atoms get ionized via electron impact ionization and the ions go to a detector. So for the single atom, it is a clear projective measurement. So that atom that ends up in the ion detector is no longer in the cloud. So that is projective. But if you think of the whole wave function, it's only a weak measurement, because we do not project the whole instantaneously the whole population in that site to zero or to a Fock state, right? So that's why it's kind of a mixture of the two. But it's a continuous measurement. I agree in the if you consider all the atoms.
Could you quantify what do you mean on dissipation? For example, here in Kros-Pitayevsky, this is the imaginary potential.
Yes.
But what's the entropy production related to that?
Well, I'm not sure whether these guys have really looked into that. Of course, what you can say, what is the rate of dissipation in that sense of how fast you remove the atoms? Well, if you ask me about entropy, probably I can't give you a good answer at the moment. I would have to look into that side. Experimentally, we have no way of measuring this entropy production. We see actually in the experiment, we only see losses. We don't see much heating. But of course, so if you just have a Schrödinger equation with an imaginary potential, that is just smoothly removing atoms. That does not necessarily give you an entropy increase. But of course, the entropy comes from the fluctuations that are related with that losses, right? But at least from what we see, we don't see much heating in the experiment.
You mentioned on your last slide about the continuous phase transitions. I mean, usually there's a Landau classification of whether something can be first or the second order. Do you have an analog here?
Yes, so I have one more slide here that is also from this Cristiano Ciutti paper, where they say what is then a second order dissipative phase transition. And in their definition, this is where this Lee-Wilson gap is zero over an extended parameter range, not only at a single point, but over a certain range. And the prerequisite to have this is that you have at least two eigenstates with eigenvalue lambda equals zero. And then you have a subspace in which you are free to arrange your density matrices and still be in this phase here. And probably you wanted more to see this formula here, because that is how they define the order of the phase transition. So you have an operator, an observable here in your steady state. So that's the expectation value of that. And then you make the thermodynamic limit here and you look which derivative kind of diverges. And that gives you then the order of the phase transition. So that is the analog definition of observable phase transition.
Are there any more questions?
What is the cross section of the adjacent atoms? Another one that you.
Yes, so we have looked into that. It's an experimental kind of question, how well you can focus the electron beam in that site. And the crosstalk, if you like, is in the order of 5%.
It's not simply, a contact interaction, because this is a charged particle. Nearby, no. Polarizable. So
no. The electron. So the ions. Once you create an ion, it immediately disappears because we have electric fields being there. If you hit it in an inelastic collision, you don't make an ion, but you have momentum transfer. Then it's also immediately out of the trap because these electrons have 5 keV. Really huge bombs. So that's the only crosstalk to neighboring sites comes from the electron beam itself, because it's small enough, but it also hits the neighboring sites.
So somehow I might have missed it, but when you go from a density matrix equation, Liouville equation,
over to something like the Schrodinger equation plus damping, you also have this projection. You have a quantum jump. Is that, how did you include this into the, in this equation? I mean, if you, I'm thinking of the work of Howard Carmichael.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So what is this effect doing in the here?
So this here is everything included, right?
Yeah, where you have, that's right.
Where you have a quantum jump and all that. And this is also kind of the system you have to analyze to find these type of quantum solution and also to see these fluctuating trajectories otherwise. I was just saying, if you want to make a mean field approximation out of this, then you get the damping and you ignore the rest. And then, of course, you have getting rid of all the fluctuations, and that might be a problem or might not a problem, but that depends then on your system.
But you have not seen that effect. That's what you're saying.
We see exactly these type of jumps. And that's why we see a multimode version of this physics here with quantum fluctuations. So we see more than a mean field type of physics here.
Are there any more questions? If not, then thank you again.